Joan Baez, singer, songwriter and civil rights activist, turns 80 next week, like John Lennon, whose birthday we celebrated here in Arena a couple of weeks back. She is an iconic figure who will forever be associated with the 1960s, in her case, with the folk revival, with Bob Dylan, and with singing this alongside Martin Luther King in 1963 at the March on Washington. Joan Baez alongside Martin Luther King and a lot of other singing, obviously, at the 1963 March on Washington. And Joan Baez, The Last Leaf, is a new biography of her extraordinary life. Its author, Elizabeth Thompson, joins me now. Let's talk, first of all, Elizabeth, about your own connection to the music of Joan Baez and your own almost accidental discovery of it as a teenager.
Yes, very weird. I mean, I was given a guitar and I had to learn to play it, a genuine Spanish guitar, by my sister's boss. She was working in Spain and he sent it from El Corte Inglés in Barcelona. And I was 11 years old, I think. In that summer between primary school and secondary school, I had to learn to play it. A neighbor showed me four chords and I found in my sister's collection this record, Joan Baez Volume 2. I'd never heard of her. And interestingly, Maureen had no recollection of ever having bought it. But the back cover showed this young woman sitting in dappled shade playing a Spanish guitar. So I thought, well, that's hopeful. So I put it on, a heavy old Vanguard record. And out came things like Barbara Allen and Banks of the Ohio and Plaisir d'Amour. And then some more difficult things like The Trees That Grow High, which had too many bar chords. But you know, things like Barbara Allen, I could do that, four or five chords. You know, I'd learned that. And then I began exploring further rather by the school library. And then I thought, wow, this woman has the most amazing voice. And then as I explored a little bit further in those old analog days, you remember when we had to go to libraries and so on and actual record shops to listen, I discovered this record of her fifth album, Joan Baez Volume 5 from 1964, which had this amazing track called Bacchanals Brasileiras on it, which I did not try to copy because it's for eight cellos and soprano, a fusion of Bach with Brazilian folk song. And I thought, wow, this woman can really sing. And then I began to realize you just played that clip of her leading a quarter of a million people in song on the steps of the Lincoln Memorial in Washington, D.C. And I realized that she'd been a part of some very significant moments that were then very recent history. This was 1969. The March on Washington was just 6 years previously. Martin Luther King had been dead a year when I began researching all this. And I realized that Baez was sort of a zealot figure, or if you like, a kind of Venn diagram through which I could explore not just the music of the American 60s and 70s as they unfolded, but American social history. And that's what I did.
Yeah, that's what the book does. And it's almost impossible, and certainly it's the tack you take in the book to separate Baez and her music from her activism. And that, I think, the apple, as they say, doesn't fall far from the tree. That started Indeed. At home with her parents, in particular her father, Albert.
Yes, I mean, very, very interesting background, I think. I was actually the first time I met her properly in 1980. I was at a press conference. She'd just done the big campaign for the boat people, and an English journalist named Derek Jewell said, "What do you understand, Miss Baez, by the saying charity begins at home?" And she said, "Well, I understand that to mean what your parents teach you." He meant, why are you worried about the boat people in the South China Sea, you know? So she's the granddaughter of ministers on both sides of her family, Scottish Episcopalian on her mother's. Her mother was born in Edinburgh. And a Catholic Mexican on her father's side, who grandfather left the Catholic Church to become a Methodist minister and was, I think, exiled from the family. And in fact, what I hadn't known until I began researching this, that he and his wife, known as Mother B and Father B, they was a really key figure in the Latin population in Brooklyn, which was the center then of the Hispanic community. And he established the first Spanish-speaking Methodist Episcopalian church in Brooklyn. And they were both really key figures for the Latino community. And they set up a summer camp in the Hudson, in the Walker Valley up in New York State for, you know, Hispanic children who would not otherwise have had a chance to leave the city and experience the outdoors. And they raised funds to take children up there, and the grandfather ran it until he died in about 1965.
And as you say, Joan certainly picked up a lot of her attitudes, left-leaning attitudes in the family, and that often landed the father in trouble. Let's listen to her singing.
Yes.
At one level, nothing more than a folk song involved here, but once you listen to the lyrics, you think there's no such thing as nothing more than a folk song.
Yeah.
I took the train to Richmond, it fell, it was a
little sound of the voice of Joan Baez there and a live version of The Night They Drove Old Dixie Down. And speaking with me this evening is Elizabeth Thompson, author of a book called Joan Baez, The Last Leaf. I suppose if we really want to start with the musical career of Joan Baez, Elizabeth, it is 1959, the Newport Folk Festival. I don't know if they were they quite electric at that stage? I don't know if Dylan had caused us trouble at that point in time.
But no, there were 6 years to go before he
caused that trouble. So she was very much an acoustic artist and very much in that folk vein. It wasn't even introduced. She was just put on the stage and off she went, type of thing.
Yes, I mean, she'd made the continuation of our last bit of our chat was that, of course, her father was a co-inventor of the X-ray microscope, and he found himself being asked to use science for defence or offensive purposes. And in an effort to kind of calm his conscience, he became a Quaker. And so the whole family went to Quaker meetings. So it was a peripatetic childhood, and it so happened that the last move she made with her family was to Boston, where her father, Cambridge, really. Her father had a kind of portfolio career of jobs at MIT and so on. So she was hanging around Harvard Square at 17, 18, supposed to be studying drama at Boston University, but actually I think she went for about 5 minutes. So she flunked it, as she always said, but she was beginning to sing in, most famously, Club 47. And this was the moment, you know, the Kingston Trio had taken Tom Dooley to the top of the charts. This was the moment when the folk revival was what every cool college kid was interested in. So there were coffee shops, as there still are quite a few around Harvard Yard. And she very quickly established herself as, you know, someone to watch. And it was Dylan's manager, actually, Albert Grossman, who wanted to manage her. She didn't want to be managed by him eventually, but he had a club, in a very famous club in Chicago called the Gate of Horn, where he sent her for a 2-week residency singing in this show compared by Bob Gibson. And he was then a very big star. And Bob Gibson was curating, as we would now say, the Newport Folk Festival. And the bill was already full, but he knew that he could get this young singer on if he simply had her come on as his guest, which he did. So they sang two numbers together, Virgin Mary and We Are Crossing Jordan River. You know, Virgin Mary, very slow, meditative song, which showed off her soprano. And then We Are Crossing Jordan River, this incredibly exciting performance, all rhythm. Sadly, there's no video, there's no, you know, film record of it, but the audio record certainly exists. It is amazingly exciting still, not quite pitch perfect, but really exciting. And when she kind of descended the stage, there was this kind of incredible fuss, and Fandango and Robert Shelton in the New York Times wrote that a star was born at the Newport Festival, this young, pure, achingly pure star. And suddenly everyone was offering a record contract.
A couple of years later, she makes a move to New York. She meets Dylan in 1961. How important was that meeting, not just professionally, but personally? What do you think the real nature of that relationship was?
Oh, well, they certainly had a relationship. I mean, it was, you know, the magazines of the time, of course, were all very excited and thinking what could come of the union of these two people. I think Grossman himself wondered that. They certainly had an affair, much of it conducted in New York at the old Hotel Earl on Washington Square, which is now the Washington Square Hotel. You could still stay in the room, and at her home in Carmel on the West Coast, where she had a cabin. The thing that people have to remember here, and the Dylan fans are very bad at it, she had seen her face on the cover of Time magazine when Dylan was still scrambling for dimes in village coffee shops. You know, she was already, she had two or three albums in the charts. So when they met that night in Gurney's Folk City in on West 4th Street, famously in the village, Greenwich Village, And she said, I want to sing some of your songs. And then she did. She began singing them on her first tour, big national tour, which was the Southern Campuses. And then, in fact, they were recorded live with God on Our Side, Don't Think Twice, It's All Right, were two of the early ones. She really was able to bring him to a mass audience. And then, crucially, she introduced him at Newport 1963. She brought him on stage, returning the favor that Bob Gibson had done her. Wow. And then she on a concert tour, and they did quite a few concerts together, and her audiences weren't necessarily pleased. You know, they'd come to hear this beautiful young soprano folk singer, and on came this growling minstrel. She won through in the end. I mean, she liked causes, and she recognized his talent. And she hoped he would be part of the kind of fight against injustice, and of course, it took her a long time to recognize that actually what he did was to give them the arsenal, the songs, but he didn't want to be at the barricades, and she has consistently been.
And that just on Joan Baez then, was that really her mission in life? Yes, singing was important, but was her mission really that activism? You know, obviously anti-Vietnam, you know, right up to the present day. She visited Bosnia. She was part of the Northern Ireland.
Yes.
She visited Northern Ireland during the time of the peace people, Betty Williams, at that particular time. Right across, you know, that latter part of the 20th century, she was behind so many different causes. Do you think that activism, in fact, was more important to her than her music, or what is the balance for you between the two?
Well, I think the two went absolutely hand. I mean, I said to her only recently, you know, you could have done opera, you know, with that voice, which I believe she could have done. She said, well, I wanted to keep my feet in the dirt, and she meant it sort of literally and metaphorically. But I think it was, I mean, she grew up, you know, she heard Martin Luther King speak when she was 16 years old, and she still cried when she talked about this profound, he was saying these things about nonviolence that she felt but couldn't yet articulate. So I think I think the music and the social activism are really indivisible. I mean, she's given up, you know, she's retired formally from the concert stage. But it wasn't really until 1990 when, you know, she told me, and we were chatting in London, and she said that, well, you know, I'd quite like to bow out of a time of my choosing. You know, the Berlin Wall had just come back down. It was a halcyon moment that, you know, things looked good. And she realized that if she wanted to kind of bow out and have a bit more of a career, she'd have to let some of the politics go. Having said that, she then almost immediately went to Sarajevo.
Yeah.
So she did. She managed to separate. So the concerts became much more concerts, and so political comment would be confined to songs, which she talked about.
And I don't know where I want to
deportee, for example, and talk about the refugees, you know.
I want to finish up with Forever Young, and I don't know how political or just how socially conscious or just how kind her recent performances of this song was. She was part of performing balcony style like the Italians, and Forever Young was the song that she chose.
What are you talking about? The kitchen songs?
Yes, the kitchen songs.
Yeah, she did a series of songs. Yeah, that was very moving in the little speeches she gave for all of them. And, you know, for Forever Young, which is, of course, the Bob Dylan song from his album Planet Waves, 1973, it's a kind of prayer in all but name. It's, you know, may your hands always be busy, your feet always be swift. You know, it's a prayer, a universal prayer, and she will be forever young. She's not 80 until January, actually. It's January the 9th, just to correct your intro.
So
I hope she's now painting and raising money by other means and actively campaigning, of course.
Young woman in her 70s. Let us not rush things on her.
She's got a bit more, yes.
We'll finish up with Forever Young, and this is not the version from the kitchen songs, but a version from earlier on. And thanks so much for speaking to us this evening. That's Elizabeth Thompson, author of the book Joan Baez, The Last Leaf, which is published by Palazzo. And let's have a little bit of Joan just to bring us to the ad break.
May you build a ladder to the stars and climb on every rung. And may you stay. May you grow up to be righteous. May you grow up.